Giddy little butterflies danced around my belly. I brushed my cheeks with my fingertips and found a big, silly grin stretched across my face. "Adam Morrow wants to date me," I told Aunt Jetty, who stood next to me as I watched him drive away. "That's weird."
"That's one very sweet boy," Jetty nodded. "Respectful, thoughtful, and kind. His mama raised him right."
"I know." I sighed, taking the flowers into the kitchen and putting them into one of Jetty's favorite pressed glass vases. Jetty nodded.
"Nice ass, too."
"Gross," I shuddered. She smirked.
"I'm dead, not blind, honey."
And still, I say, "Ew." I grabbed my purse and slipped into my coat. On a whim, I grabbed Jetty's old wicker picnic hamper out of the front closet. I don't have time for this. I need to go be confused by the man I'm actually dating. As it turned out, Gabriel was the one who was confused.
"What's wrong?"
he asked as he opened his front door before I could even knock. It was more than the weary tone that had little alarm bells going off in my head. Gabriel's face was drawn and pinched. His eyes were a dull slate color and lacked the spark I'd come to expect. He looked almost ill. This was more than just traveler's stress. Something was wrong. But I could tell by his guarded expression that asking would leave me without answers and alone on a perfectly good date night.
"Nothing,"
I said, smiling to hide my worries. "Absolutely nothing."
"You never come to see me unless you're angry or something's gone wrong,"
I gasped, feigning hurt. "That's not true."
"The first time you were here, you came storming up my front steps because I'd sent Andrea over to your house. The last time you were here, it was because Zeb and Jolene were on the verge of collapse. We never spend time here. I'm always at your place."
"You know, you're right. I'm so sorry. I'm terrible at the relationship thing." He shrugged.
"You just like to be comfortable."
He sniffed slightly, then ran the tip of his nose down my hairline. I took this as a sweet, intimate gesture until he asked,
"Why do you smell like a German shepherd?"
I stared at him, thinking maybe this was some sort of bizarre riddle, when I realized Adam's ode to canine had probably rubbed on me when I plowed into him. I blew out a startled laugh. "Oh, I ran into an old friend from high school, Adam Morrow. He's a vet, and he must have had some leftover dog residue on him."
"You ran into him on the drive over here?"
Gabriel asked.
"No,
he dropped by the house to say hi just as I was walking out the door," I said, the suspicion in his voice setting off my babble response. "It's no big deal. It's really kind of funny. It's this boy I used to have this huge crush on when we were kids, but he never looked twice at me. I was his gawky band geek, and he was the most popular boy in our class. But now that I've been turned and grown out of my braces, I guess he's interested in me. I told him I was seeing someone, and it's too little too late, obviously. I mean, I'm a grown woman, and it was just a silly schoolgirl fantasy crush thing. I'm over him, completely, totally, completely and totally over him." Gabriel grimaced, his features radiating doubt and discomfort. Maybe that second completely and totally was overselling it. "So, take me on the tour," I suggested, changing the subject far too enthusiastically. "I've only seen two rooms of your house, the parlor and your bedroom."
"That wasn't my bedroom," he said. "That was a guest room."
"You left your fledgling vampire child to rise in your guest room?" His lips twitched, and I could see him slowly coming out of his bad humor.
"Where would you put a fledgling vampire child to rise?"
I paused to think about it.
"I don't know.
So, show me your bedroom. And I mean that in a perfectly respectable home tour kind of way." Gabriel's bedroom was surprising. I'd expected something lavish and baroque, sort of Henry VIII meets Rudolph Valentino. But the walls were bare, a pale blue edging toward purple, the color of the sky just after dawn. The bed was wide and soft but plain, something you'd order from IKEA and then immediately regret. A thick navy tapestry curtain was pulled back, revealing a broad cushioned window seat, the only seating in the room. And his bathroom featured a shower big enough for six. He specifically mentioned that, which, frankly, worried me. I ducked my head into his closet. Black, as far as the eye could see. Black t-shirts, black sweaters, black button-down shirts, black slacks, broken up only by occasional splashes of slate gray. "You ever thought about wearing a print?" I asked.
Maybe even a jewel tone? One of the less intense colors, blue, green. How about red? We know you like that one. Wait, are you colorblind?
I don't wear jewel tones, Gabriel muttered, leading me back out into the bedroom. Or prints.
There were no pictures, no mirrors, nothing on the walls save for a print of Edvard Munch's Vampire. An ambiguous portrait of a semi-nude, red-headed woman with her arms around and head bent over a dark-haired man. I stood, studying the image with a tilted head. Is he the vampire? Is she? Is he simply a lover seeking comfort at his redhead's breast? Or are they two humans cowered in the shadow of the dark form looming behind them?
What do you think of it?
He asked. It's beautiful, and sad, and vague, I said.
You know, the original title of the painting was Love and Pain, he said. An art critic picked up on the underlying vampiric theme, and the name stuck. Munch experts were and are horrified, but you can't deny the subconscious imagery.
You know, his ears are sort of shaped like yours, I commented, looking from the slightly pointed painted ovals to Gabriel's own lobes. Gabriel grinned.
The artist found the back of my head to be quite compelling.
So this is an altar to your vanity? I asked, teasing.
I enjoy the irony. A man interpreting me as a vampire, but being told it's impossible. What brought you rushing to my front door if it wasn't bad news?
He asked as I pulled him back down the stairs toward a surprise I'd brought for him. He offered more than a little resistance as I pulled him farther and farther from the bedroom. I thought we might actually leave the house for a date. I figured we've covered the couch date. You are the master of the corner lean and the casual back rub that might lead to something. I thought you might like to up the degree of difficulty. It's time to leave the comfort of the makeout couch, Gabriel. Let's go out to see a movie. He arched his eyebrows at me as I pulled him to the foyer. Moving images projected onto a screen in front of a darkened room full of people. He shot me a withering look. And since I don't think even your broad horizons are quite ready for the hollow cineplex, I thought we would visit the Dollar Theater.
The Dollar Theater?
The old two-screen place downtown. They show old movies for a dollar a ticket. It's sort of a gamble. Sometimes you see the ending, sometimes the film melts. But the seats are cushy, and there's a lot of ambiance.
You mean the Palladium?
I chewed my lip. I think that's what the sputtering neon sign says.
The Palladium used to be the premier moving picture palace in this end of the state. I saw my first film there, Casablanca.
You waited until the 1940s to see your first movie?
He shrugged. I had things to do.
Well, now the Palladium is the place where you can buy a bucket of beer with some very stale popcorn.
But all those humans... We're vampires. If someone talks during the movie, we'll tear their throats out.
Come on, I wore my cute date shoes and everything. He peered down at the strappy black pumps peeking out from my jeans.
You know I can't resist you when your toes are exposed, he grumped.
Good. That means wearing open-toed shoes in winter is well worth it. And since we can't exactly swing by for a pizza on our way into town, I brought you this. I pulled a very nice bottle of donated Type B positive, which I knew Gabriel favored, from the picnic basket.
Very nice, he commented, appraising the label. Your palate is improving.
Thank you. Now let's go.
What about drinking this?
I have a whole thing planned. Just relax that ramrod spine of yours and come with me. I took Gabriel to Memorial Park, a tiny patch of grass in the middle of downtown. It was home to a gazebo, flanked by blackened cement statues of former Civil War veterans from the Hollow, including Waco Marchand, who now served on the local commission for the Council for the Equal Treatment of the Undead. High school kids posed for pictures in their prom night finery at the gazebo each spring, but tonight it was abandoned, empty save for the fairy lights strung from the carefully preserved gingerbread eaves. I winked at Gabriel and began unpacking the picnic basket on one of the gazebo's little wrought iron benches.
It's December,
Gabriel said, staring at me and tucking his coat tighter around his body. We stay at room temperature, I reminded him, patting the bench.
Besides, we have twinkly Christmas lights only available at this time of year. We have a lovely bottle of Oaky B Positive. We have grapes and cheese, which, I'll admit, I bought on the way over to your house strictly because I've seen people pack them for fancy wine picnics and movies. We have romance and atmosphere out the yin-yang. He gave me a smile that assured me that he was working hard to humor my girly romanticism. I'm wearing the date shoes, I reminded him.
Curse your sassy toes, he huffed. Let me open that. You don't want to cork it.
Are you implying that a little old thing like me can't operate something as complicated as a corkscrew? He grinned at my indignant tone.
Okay, you're right. But that's not because I'm a woman. It's because most of the stuff I drank when I was alive involved screw tops.
I've always enjoyed your little quirks. He grunted at the faint pop of the cork coming loose. He carefully poured into the plastic wine glasses that came with the picnic set.
What do we drink to?
World peace? I suggested. He grimaced. To doing things that normal couples do? He cleared his throat and raised his glass.
To Mrs. Mavis Stubblefield, without whom we would not be here together tonight.
I laughed. That's kind of twisted. He nodded while he sipped.
But true.
To Mavis Stubblefield, without whom I wouldn't have been fired, publicly drunk, mistaken for a deer, shot, and turned into a vampire by you, I conceded, and took a deep drink. Despite my pacifist leanings, I enjoyed the sizzle of human red cells as they zipped through my system. Maybe I should send her a thank you note.
We both know that's not going to happen.
Also true, I admitted, snuggling my head into the crook of his neck.
What are you doing?
Enjoying the moment, I sighed.
You are, without a doubt, the most interesting girl I've ever shared a gazebo with, he murmured, kissing my forehead.
Interesting. There's your favorite word again.
I think we've established how interested I am in you, he chuckled, kissing me.
He sighed when he released me.
I feel as if we haven't been able to spend much time together lately. I'm sorry business has taken so much of my time.
My lips parted, and I could feel the rush of questions gathering. Why wasn't he answering his phone? Why was he being so uncharacteristically vague about his travels? Where had he been, really? But the evening was so perfect, so relaxed. Again, passages from Sense and Sensibility popped into my head. Eleanor almost loses her Edward because she doesn't speak up and tell him how she feels. She might have ended up alone, but Lucy Steele lets Edward off the hook by eloping with his brother. Would Edward stay in love with Eleanor if she pitched a tantrum when he left her at Norland without confirming his feelings? Would making demands and ultimatums confirm that Edward made the right choice in Lucy? I was an Eleanor, not a Marianne. I didn't want to waste precious, uninterrupted time together with outbursts or questions that might provoke an argument. So I fainted for a safer topic. It has helped that I've been all about wedding, wedding, and more wedding lately, I sighed. Tell me how it's possible that this shindig has taken complete control of my life and I'm not even the one getting married. I'm just a lowly bridesmaid, and yet I'm the one doing the cocktail napkin comparisons and in-law interventions. He mulled that over for a moment.
Oh, I saw this in one of those ladies' magazines you leave scattered around at your house. I think the term is bridezilla.
I don't know if I would use the word bridezilla. It's not that Jolene's being all that demanding or... Yeah, wear a bride just about covers it, I admitted. I don't know what to do. I just keep getting pulled in. Dress fittings, engagement parties from hell, favor-making parties. It's not that I don't have the time, I'm just getting worn out, you know? But I don't think any of her cousins will do any of this stuff with her.
And her fiancé has made vague yet disturbing advances toward you and is treating her badly so you feel incredibly guilty.
No, I insisted. I looked down into my glass and grumbled.
Yes. You're a very good friend.
I waited for the sage advice he normally dished out in these situations, and got nothing. And?
That's all the platitudes I have, he said. Generally, people don't invite vampires to their weddings, much less make them their undead burial handmaidens. This is a situation I have never had to deal with. In more than a century? He gave me an apologetic look. Well, that's disappointing, I said, looking down at my watch. We better get going or we're going to miss the previews. I thought the theater only showed movies that are at least 20 years old. That means the previews are for movies that are 20 years old. I drained the last of my blood. There's a principle at stake here, Gabriel. Since we were sticking to strict dating principles, Gabriel insisted on paying the $2 admission. He was a little put off when he saw our options listed on the old-fashioned marquee. Pillow Talk, or the 1932 version of Dracula, starring Bela Lugosi.
Isn't that sort of obvious?
He asked. Oh, we'll go see Pillow Talk if you really want to. We're talking singing, Tony Randall, lots of pastels. Gabriel shuddered.
Dracula it is.
It was oddly fitting that our first real date involved Dracula, considering that our first couch date featured Francis Ford Coppola's version, which Gabriel still insisted is a comedic spoof on the tale. We took two slightly sprung seats near the rear of the theater and settled in. Seeing the dilapidated state of the theater obviously bothered Gabriel. The gold leaf had worn away from the plaster angels guarding the screen long ago. The red velvet curtain was moth-eaten and dirty. The balcony railing was studded with generations of grayed chewing gum. I narrowed my eyes at him as he squirmed uncomfortably in his seat.
You're going to buy this place, aren't you?
I'm thinking about it,
he confessed, wiping at a mysterious sticky substance that had transferred itself from the armrest to his hand.
This is criminal.
Well, if it would keep you in town for a while, I'm all for it.
How many of us are in here?
I asked as he scanned the crowd.
Can you tell?
A few, he admitted.
This version of Dracula is one of the few movie adaptations that vampires find generally palatable. The main character is powerful yet somewhat sympathetic.
Gabriel looked nervous as he continued to scan the crowd.
You okay? I asked. Fine.
He smiled.
So, what is the procedure for a movie date?
Well, we sit here, not touching until the lights go out. Eventually, we'll bump knees or fight for elbow rest dominance. If we ate popcorn, we might pay an incredibly exorbitant amount of money for a bucket to keep between us so our hands could occasionally brush against each other as we reached for bites. If you were a total pervert, you'd cut a hole in the bottom of the bucket. Never mind. He shot me a questioning glance. There's also a yawn maneuver, which we've covered in previous sessions.
Excuse me for a minute.
Gabriel walked out of the theater, leaving me to look over the crowd. Most of them were older couples, people who might have seen the original theater run when they were children. There were a few teenagers in goth regalia, some of whom I recognized as skateboarders I'd had to chase away from the shop. If there were vampires here, I couldn't spot them. Gabriel came back, carrying an obscenely large tub of popcorn.
Did you know that butter comes in a liquid chemical form?
He asked, grinning over the oil-slicked kernels.
But we can't eat it,
I giggled as he set the tub between us.
You said this is what people do on dates. I wanted to do this right.
I grabbed his face between my palms and kissed him good. This was the Gabriel I'd fallen for. I could put up with the uncertainty, the brain-racking questions for just a little taste of this kind of happiness.
Are we skipping the popcorn hand-brushing thing?
He asked between nips on my lips.
Hey, go get a room!
Bellowed a loud male voice behind us. Gabriel glared over my head at the elderly hall monitor. I giggled as he stood up and headed in the guy's direction.
Sit down, I told him.
Gabriel glared at the loudmouth.
But that was very rude.
It's all part of the experience. Gabriel mastered the yawn move and the knee squeeze and was well on his way to the around-the-shoulder chest grab by the time the credits rolled. As we left the theater, he talked animatedly about seeing Bela Lugosi play Dracula in the original Broadway play.
But I must admit that his screen performance was even more compelling. It's fascinating that they managed to film his eyes as ours appear, as if lit from within.
He had help. The cinematographer shone little pinpoint spotlights into his eyes during filming.
It was the cheapest, most effective way to get the effect. Did you know that there was a Spanish-language version of the movie shot at night on the same set with different actors?
No, but it makes sense that you do.
So, what do you think of dating outside our homes?
It reminded me of my youth. Being close to a beautiful woman I wanted desperately to touch and not being able to,
he said, winding his arms around me as he led me to his car. I chewed my lip and made a pouty face.
Was there a good-looking woman sitting next to us?
Are you ever going to just take a compliment and not turn it into a joke? I considered for a moment and shook my head.
Not likely. Nope.
We had a few blocks to walk before reaching the car. It was a beautiful night, and I was enjoying strolling down a downtown sidewalk arm in arm with a handsome man. The downtown area was an odd mix of beautifully refurbished buildings and abandoned storefronts. One of those lovingly restored buildings contained the Coffee Spot, a hollow institution known for bad java and unbelievable pecan pie. My father and I used to make up errands on Saturday mornings, then hide out at the Coffee Spot and eat cheese fries. From across the street, I peered through the windows, smiling at the memory of Mama demanding to know how Daddy had gotten melted Velveeta on his shirt during a trip to the hardware store. I was about to seize an opportunity to share a non-disturbing experience from my human years with Gabriel when I recognized two faces in a front booth. It was Mama Ginger and my synapse-slapping senior friend, Esther Barnes.
What the...
I couldn't step closer to the window for fear of Mama Ginger's internal Jane tracking device going off. Instead, I ducked behind a nearby car and squinted at them, really hard.
Jane?
Gabriel grinned, staring down at me.
What are you?
Shh! I hissed, pulling at his coat and making him crouch next to me.
This seems unnecessary,
Gabriel grumbled, frowning as I shushed him again.
We will discuss the shushing later.
Framed by the coffee shop's logo in the window, Mama Ginger and Esther seemed to be arguing. Knowing Mama Ginger, this was not unexpected. She'd once started a fistfight at a Relay for Life meeting over whether her card club's booth should be luau or casino-themed. I couldn't hear through the glass, but both Esther and Mama Ginger talked with their hands. Esther was pointing one of her long, bony fingers at Mama Ginger and then made a gesture that meant, "More money," or, "I need moisturizer." Mama Ginger was shaking her head and seemed to be saying,
I need it sooner.
I tried to zero in on Mama Ginger's thoughts, but heard only white noise. I looked up to Gabriel, who was sticking a finger in his ear and seemed to be trying to pop some pressure loose.
You too?
I asked, narrowing my gaze at the septuagenarian psychic. Maybe Esther's psychic presence acted like some sort of scrambler, keeping both of us from reading the people around her. I clutched a fist and shook it at her.
Esther Barnes.
I watched their conversation for a few more minutes, culminating in Esther's threatening to get up and leave. Mama Ginger made placating gestures and finally broke out her wallet. She slid some cash across the table, which Esther counted. Twice. I waited for either of them to get up and leave. Maybe if I could get Mama Ginger alone, I could ask her a few questions about Esther. But they wouldn't budge. They both seemed determined to win some sort of impromptu pie-eating contest. Sighing in exasperation at my own suspicious nature, I stood up, turned my back on the scene, and brushed off my coat. More than likely, all I was witnessing was some sort of illegal transaction involving unlicensed Precious Moments figurines.
Can we stop skulking now?
Gabriel asked. I nodded and quickly led him away before Mama Ginger could spot us.
Is everything okay?
He asked.
I don't know.
That woman that Mama Ginger's talking to, she walked into the shop the other night and, well, she smacked my brain around in a psychic sense. I don't like that she and Mama Ginger are talking. The two of them joining forces cannot possibly be good for Zeb, or mankind in general. Gabriel nodded solemnly.
Agreed.
I put my arm through Gabriel's and tried to resuscitate our date night as we walked away. Did I ever tell you that my dad and I used to go to that coffee shop every weekend? Chapter 8. Werewolves look for three key components in a mate: ability to hunt, viable genes, and a sense of humor. mating rituals, and love customs of the Ware. I shouldn't have told Mama to Photoshop me into the family Christmas picture. She'd found some photo kiosk at the mall and cropped in a picture from 3 Christmases ago, taken just after I'd had minor dental surgery. With eyes both red and bleary, I was wobbling near the rear of the tree, attempting to hang an angel ornament in midair. Everyone else in the family is smiling and looking at the camera, with this year's hair, and I was copied and pasted into a corner as if my top half was springing out of the tree. Mama sent it to 120 of our nearest and dearest, including Zeb.
"It looks like Christmas Night of the Living Dead," he hooted.
"That's incredibly culturally insensitive," I muttered. "See if I invite you to my Christmas party."
"Oh, sweetie, you know it's not Christmas without us watching A Christmas Story until one of us passes out."
Zeb and I usually spent Christmas Eve together. He could only handle so much of his parents and used me as a reason to get away. We would hoard as much peanut butter fudge and sausage balls as possible, then hide out at Zeb's place to watch Christmas movies. Gifts were exchanged. Relatives were avoided. God bless us, everyone. But this year we were having a holly jolly undead Christmas at River Oaks. Gabriel had promised to be there, which was fortunate because I'd found the perfect present for him. Zeb was bringing Jolene, as Mama Ginger had made it clear that she was not welcome at the Lavelle family Christmas. Andrea was coming, which meant Dick would be there, even though he said he had plans that night. Fred and Jetty would try to fit us into their busy holiday schedule. Of course, Mr. Wainwright would be there. He was eager to question Jolene about her family. River Oaks hadn't been opened for a big party since the Great Depression, when great-great-great-grandpa Early lost a good portion of the family fortune in oil speculation in Florida. It was the first adult party I'd ever hosted, with real hors d'oeuvres and fancy clothes. I put up a real spruce tree and brought out all of the old glass ornaments. I hung fairy lights from every stationary object in the house. I lit a couple dozen good vanilla-scented candles and then blew half of them out. Having a lot of open flames around highly flammable guests was surely the mark of an inconsiderate hostess. Jolene promised to handle the human food, which was fortunate, since I think my stove had atrophied from disuse. Jolene said it just didn't seem fair to make me cook stuff I couldn't eat. I asked if she could put that in writing and send it to my mama. Jolene was also providing a crock pot full of cow's blood from her farm for the undead guests. I thought about adding spices to make it sort of a mulled wine thing, but Mr. Wainwright advised strongly against it. He even gave me a book titled Elegant Undead Entertaining. Based on the foods that vampires can prepare without becoming nauseated menu, I was providing crackers and cheese, fancy cookies, and sparkling cider, and thanked the ever-patient, ever-generous officials of the Visa Corporation for providing the groceries. With the tree, the candles, and the scent of blood warming in the crock pot, the house smelled wonderfully of home and hearth. My standards have changed a bit. All that was left was for me to run around like a crazy person, double and triple checking everything. Pretty decorations? Check. Good food? Check. Not telling Mama about it? Check. It was the recipe for the perfect party. And what else would a vampire wear to a Christmas party but a blood-red cocktail dress? It was perfect, fabulous even, maybe the most flattering dress I'd ever worn. Cinched at the waist, with a scarlet sash and a rhinestone poinsettia brooch, the luscious, floaty material fell in a perfect bell around my knees. I even broke the curse of bridesmaid shoe past, finally finding a use for those sassy pomegranate-dyed pumps. Believe it or not, I found the dress in Aunt Jetty's closet. Jetty wasn't always a sweatsuit fanatic. She was quite the sharp dresser before she declared open rebellion against foundation garments. And fortunately, we were both tall, athletically built girls. And it smelled nothing like mothballs, so double points for me.
"Everything looks wonderful, honey," Jetty said as I changed the CD in the stereo for the 14th time.
I have no centralized music taste. I listen to an alarming amount of Sarah McLachlan, the Deftones, and the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Musically, I kind of got stuck in the 1990s. Gabriel called my CD collection pedantic. I think he forgot he was dealing with someone who knew what pedantic means. Unfortunately, my pedantic collection did not include any Christmas music. So we had a choice between celebrating the birth of baby Christ with Suck My Kiss or a Lilith Fair concert recording. Neither felt appropriate, so I settled for the regional NPR station's broadcast of Handel's Messiah. Maybe I should arrange that... I turned toward the candles.
Don't! Jetty cried. Honey, they're perfect, and it's not good for you to handle candles too much.
I relented, and she stepped back, motioning for me to raise my arms.
Now let me see you. That dress never looked that good on me.
Fibber. I rolled my eyes.
I don't know any one-word insults for false modesty, but I'll come up with one, she said. In the meantime, sit, catch your breath, relax. Enjoy this quiet time when the house looks perfect and you look beautiful and no one is frazzled or complaining that they can't eat anything because of their lactose intolerance.
That's lovely, I said. Which shelter magazine did you get that from? She grinned.
Original material. Now I'm going to go stare at the cheese and crackers and long for days gone by.
You and me both, I muttered as someone or something battered at my kitchen door. Jolene, werewolf strength abounding, threw open the door with her hip and lugged a Coleman chest cooler into my kitchen. Either that's a lot of food or you're planning a really cheap funeral in my backyard, I said, eyeing the man-sized cooler. Zeb hefted a tray of mini-quiches onto my counter.
Given your luck this year, do you really think you should be joking about that?
Duly noted, I said as Jolene unpacked a ham, mashed potatoes, stuffing, rolls, and what looked like a 20-pound deep-fried turkey. How many people are you planning to feed?
Me, Zeb, Mr. Wainwright, your friend Andrea,
she said, ticking off on her fingers.
Do you think I brought enough?
I held up a 2-gallon Tupperware container of yams. Well, if nothing else, I have some pot pies in my freezer.
You have more pot pies?
Jolene cried, looking at the freezer with longing.
Now you went and ruined her Christmas present, Zeb grinned.
Gabriel came to the door looking almost festive. He was wearing a dark blue scarf, which may have been the only time I'd ever seen him wear an actual color. He was also carrying a load of packages, several bottles, and a bright pink bakery box.
You're all coiffed, he said, clearly shocked.
I am capable of cleaning up nice, I said grumpily.
Very nice,
he nodded and gave me a friendly peck.
That was just sad,
a voice behind us drawled. We turned to see Dick, radiant in a holly green T-shirt that said, Join me on the naughty list, carrying presents, a bottle of Boone's Farm, and a sprig of mistletoe.
I've seen old people kiss better than that. Aunt Jetty's kissing Fred better than that right now.
In honor of the occasion, Jetty and Fred had agreed to let all of the guests see them. I turned to my living room to find that Grandpa Fred had materialized and was indeed kissing Aunt Jetty like a character in an old World War II movie. Well, that's just embarrassing, I said, pushing Gabriel's packages into Dick's hands and laying a hell of a smooch on my special vampire fella. Happy now?
Blech, no, Dick grimaced. It's like watching your parents make out.
Gabriel set his jaw and advanced on Dick. Okay, River Oaks is neutral ground. You both promised, I said, standing between the two of them. Gabriel, please go inside. Help Jolene unpack her movable feast. I turned on Dick.
I thought you had plans, I said, leaning against the door and smirking at him. Yeah, well, they fell through. I figured, why not throw you a bone?
I'm just not responding to that imagery, I said as I accepted what could only be termed wine in the strictest sense of the word. But I'm glad you're here. Merry Christmas, Dick. You have just enough time to go inside and look cool and unaffected when Andrea comes in. Dick perked up. But first, a few ground rules. No ho-ho-ho jokes. That shirt is the only naughty reference you're allowed tonight. And keep the mistletoe where I can see it, I said.
Well, tie my hands, why don't you?
He grumbled, then scrambled to get inside when he saw Andrea's car pull into my drive.
Andrea had volunteered to drive Mr. Wainwright, whose night vision was not what it once was. Neither was his day vision, for that matter. It took Gabriel and me to help him up the steps, but he was determined to carry his own presence and the jar of potpourri he had brought as a hostess gift. At least I hoped it was potpourri. Oddly enough, the first person he greeted when he walked into the living room was my Aunt Jetty, who was confused but flattered.
"He can see me?"
"You can see her?" I asked. "I thought vampires were the only ones who could see you, when you decided to grace us with your presence, that is." Mr. Wainwright chuckled.
"Well, of course I can see her. She's standing right there. She's a bit transparent, but still visible to those who have a broader personal perspective."
"Jetty Early, meet my boss, Gilbert Wainwright," I said. "Mr. Wainwright, my late great Aunt Jetty."
"Charmed," he said.
I noticed that he didn't offer to shake her hand, an effort to avoid calling attention to the fact that she was non-corporeal.
"Jane's told me so much about you," Jetty said, smiling sweetly. "I'm so glad she's found such a wonderfully interesting person to work for."
"Well, she is a pleasure to have at the store," he assured her. "She has revolutionized our filing system."
"She said you didn't have a filing system before she was hired," Jetty pointed out.
My gaze shifted from my aunt to my employer. Did Aunt Jetty just giggle in a coquettish manner, drawing a suspicious look from my dead step-grandpa? Mr. Wainwright chuckled again and adjusted his suspenders. My dead aunt was flirting with my boss. My dead aunt, who was practically engaged to my dead step-grandfather, and my boss appeared to be flirting back. This could go nowhere good. They started talking and realized they'd gone to high school together. They were in the last class to graduate from the original Half Moon Hollow High before Milton Firebug Chambers burned it to the ground. They reminisced about Mr. Allen, the math teacher who spoke in the third person, the design of the first ever Half Moon Howler mascot costume, and Milton's multiple failed attempts at burning the school down before he got it right. Mr. Wainwright asked Aunt Jetty about her demise and how the Tunnel of Light appeared to her. Jetty laughed uproariously and told him it was more like a tornado. Eager to catch every detail, he asked Jetty to meet him at his office sometime where he could interview her properly. Grandpa Fred was not pleased. Fortunately, he couldn't solve this problem as he did when Grandma Ruthie drove him crazy during his living Christmases, drinking buttered rum until he was nearly comatose, forcing my dad and I to cart him, bark-a-lounger and all, out to the car. It's awkward introducing two groups of friends. It's even more awkward when one of those groups decides not to like the other. While Mr. Wainwright was thrilled to be acquainted or reacquainted with the supernatural beings, Jolene had taken an instant dislike to Andrea. A few minutes after the two of them gingerly shook hands, Jolene pulled me into the kitchen to whisper at a decibel far below human hearing that she didn't trust her. "I trust Andrea," I said. "She's been a really good friend to me. You're just used to being the prettiest girl in the room and having someone who remotely rivals your blinding hotness is throwing you off your game. And we don't have to whisper. Andrea's perfectly normal hearing is not going to pick up this conversation."
"I'm just saying, one girl to another, I think you need to watch her around Gabriel," Jolene said, grabbing a hunk of cheddar and chowing down.
"Around the cheese," she said.
"A lot of girls, especially wounded human girls, go for the whole mysterious, dark-haired guy with the full lips, piercing, soulful eyes, cheekbones you could slice a ham with."
"Maybe I should watch you around Gabriel," I said, eyeing her warily. "I think we should get back into the living room with your lovely canapés before everybody else figures out that we're talking about one of them."
"You're right. I'm being silly,"
Jolene said, watching Zeb try one of Mr. Wainwright's cigars, then get pounded on the back when he started to choke.
"I just want everybody to be as happy as Zeb and me."
"Lovebirds on amphetamines couldn't be happier than you two," I said, linking arms with her. She sighed, leaning her head against mine.
"I know."
I lingered and watched the party from the kitchen doorway. Someone, mercifully, had dug up a Nat King Cole CD. Even over the bluesy cheer, I could hear Andrea and Zeb chatting about the merits of being the only normals in the room. They didn't consider Mr. Wainwright to be normal. Jolene swept in and marked her territory by kissing Zeb's cheek and pulling him away from Andrea. Gabriel and Mr. Wainwright discussed Gabriel's library and its shocking lack of information on freshwater sea monsters until Dick distracted Gabriel by mentioning all of the parties they used to attend at River Oaks. Gabriel sent a furtive look my way. I think he offered Dick money not to reminisce further. Mr. Wainwright then engaged Dick in adamant conversation regarding the sales of werepelts on the black market. Dick was smiling at him in a way I didn't normally see. It was almost tender, and it was weirding me out.
"Please, in the name of Christmas, don't let Dick try to sell him anything," I asked, looking skyward.
Fortunately, Andrea passed by in her slinky black party dress, and Dick's attention shifted gears. Mr. Wainwright grinned as Dick trailed after her. He made eye contact with Aunt Jetty, rolled his eyes, and muttered,
"Young people."
Aunt Jetty gave a girlish giggle, which got Grandpa Fred's back up. Andrea heard Mr. Wainwright's side of the conversation and tapped me on the shoulder.
"Is Mr. Wainwright talking to himself again?"
she asked.
"Nope.
Aunt Jetty. I think he might have a little bit of a crush going. This is going to be a big shock for Grandpa Fred. This may be the love triangle that undoes the fabric of our universe." She cringed. Gabriel sauntered my way, offering me a punch cup of an imported dessert blood called sangre.
"You throw a great party," Gabriel said, nodding at the happy crowd.
"God bless us, everyone," I said, grinning. "This may actually be the best Christmas ever. People I love, no pressure, no drunk cousins fist-fighting on the lawn."
"Well, I'm sure that's an interesting story that I'll ask you about later."
He cringed before calling across the room,
"While we're on the subject of families, Zeb, can you tell me why your mother has been leaving me increasingly threatening voicemail messages? She plans to put her foot, among other things, up several orifices."
"I honestly don't know," Zeb said. "It's possible she just dialed a random number. Sometimes she leaves those messages for strangers."
"I think I know," I said, sighing. "Zeb's mama seems to think you're the only obstacle standing between me and Zeb, true love, and some sort of precious moments wedding extravaganza." Zeb seemed stunned, but not nearly as disturbed by this as I was. He smiled at me with that weird, glazed-over stare, which was becoming way too familiar. I moved closer to Gabriel, twining my fingers through his. "You might want to keep your doors locked during the day, Gabriel. Also, cover your butt, because what she has planned would sting a little."
"I don't think Mama would actually do anything," Zeb assured me, his voice low and soft.
"Easy for you to say," I told Zeb. "It's not your orifices at stake."
"And on that lovely Yuletide note, I have something for you," Gabriel said,
leading me closer to the lights of the Christmas tree before handing me a small, silver-wrapped package. With visions of jewelry dancing in my head, I opened it to find a little canister with a plastic trigger.
"Mace?" "Nope. Silver in aerosol form," he said proudly. "To prevent further parking lot fights. Just don't stand downwind when you use it."
"Oh, how thoughtful," I said, lifting it carefully from the box. With all the enthusiasm I could scrape together, I told him, "It's really, really great."
"It's a gag gift," he said crossly. "Zeb said you'd find this kind of thing funny. Lift up the tissue."
"Zeb has spent most of his adult years playing Game Boy alone on Friday nights," I said, rooting to the bottom of the box. "Don't take relationship advice from Zeb." In the bottom of the box was a tissue-wrapped bundle. It was a little silver unicorn on a fine chain.
"Andrea said that paying homage to a little quirk in your personality, the closet unicorn obsession, would show that I care," he said.
"It really does," I told him. "Can I touch it?"
"It would be a good first step toward wearing it."
"But it's silver," I said, hooking a tissue-protected finger around the clasp.
"No, it's white gold,"
he said as he looped the chain around my neck.
"Perfectly safe for vampires."
"All of the beauty of silver without the burning and itching," I cooed, running my fingers over the curves of the unicorn's tiny legs.
Does that mean thank you in your language? He asked, tilting his head.
Thank you. It's very sweet, I said, kissing him. This is a wonderful coincidence because I have this for you.
Across the room, Zeb was making a sour face. Jolene jostled his arm, attempting to tease the scowl from him, but he shook her off, stalking toward the kitchen and out of sight. She stared after him, her face twisted into confused, hurt lines. Dick saw this and asked some random question about his responsibilities as the man of honor and how it related to cummerbund color, teasing her into a smile. I handed Gabriel a square package. I was sorting through some old family photos with Aunt Jetty. We found this. Jetty and I spent hours looking through old boxes of River Oaks tintypes when I was a little girl. We would study the sepia-toned photos of Early's from the 1870s and comment on the clothes, the hairstyles, who looked like toothless Uncle Vernon. Somehow we always voted for Grandma Ruthie. Jetty would tell me stories about my ancestors, such as great-great-great-grandma Lula, who set fire to the Hollow's only cat house after finding her husband, the Reverend James Early, proselytizing there. The fire took out the cat house, a nearby saloon, and the general store, where the owner sold dirty French pictures from the back room. She did more good in 45 minutes with an oil lamp than Reverend Early did in 35 years of preaching. We're a proud family. On a recent trip down disturbing genealogical memory lane, Jetty and I found portraits from Clarissa and Stuart Early's wedding in 1877. In one smaller photo, two young Early cousins, Leah and Mariah, were shown smiling up at two strapping fellows in silk coats. I had seen this photo 100 times before I was turned. Until now, I hadn't recognized the young men being adored by my simpering foremothers, Dick and Gabriel, grinning like mad at the camera. They were so young. And Dick actually had his arm around Gabriel's shoulders, laughing as if he had just told some raunchy joke. I'd taken the photos to a camera shop to have copies of the print made. I'd framed one for Gabriel and one for Dick. It was not a manipulative parent-trap ploy. I honestly couldn't think of anything else to get them.
I remember this day, Gabriel said, grinning. This was right before Dick persuaded your cousins to go skinny dip.
He caught sight of my raised eyebrows.
Never mind.
Dick came to peer over Gabriel's shoulder.
Leah and Mariah, twins in every sense of the word.
Did you leave any of my cousins untouched? I cried, remembering Dick's fondness for my ancestor, Cousin Ceci.
Dick guffawed. Hey, Gabriel's the one who...
Gabriel narrowed his eyes at Dick.
Never mind.
Horrifying revelations, and the confirmation that some of my relatives were publicly nude. You know, suddenly this has become like Christmas with my family. Thanks, I said, patting them on the back. Gabriel's cell phone sounded. Okay, so it wasn't the most mature thing to do, but I snuck a look at the caller ID. It read, Janine. I didn't know any Janine. Gabriel had never mentioned a Janine. Who the hell was Janine? I practically chewed through my tongue to keep from commenting. He took the call outside, and, I'm ashamed to say, I sort of lurked around the door to try to overhear, but he stepped off the porch out of my range of hearing through the glass. Defeated, I turned to the eating crowd. Who's ready for dinner? Jolene wasn't the only one who could plan a tablescape. I had clear glass bowls of various sizes filled with vanilla candles and cranberries, great-grandma Early's wedding tablecloth, and the good china with the delicate silver ivy pattern. I was going for a good housekeeping look, which tends to be less angry than Martha Stewart living. I used gloves to set out the silver place settings for the humans.
You spent 6 hours setting a table for food you can't eat,
Zeb marveled. He took it upon himself to escort me to the table since Gabriel was otherwise occupied. It's my first vampire Christmas, I said. I still want to enjoy dinner. Gabriel appeared at my right, ready to seat me, and seemed a little put off when Zeb did not relinquish my hand or take the seat I'd assigned him across from Jolene. He seemed intent on sitting next to me, forcing Gabriel to sit next to a confused werewolf bride-to-be.
I'm surprised you didn't mix eggnog in your blood, snorted Dick. Jane's firmly anti-nog in all its forms, Zeb told him, pulling out my chair.
Caught off guard by Zeb's clueless move, I made a quick comment along the lines of, eggs, milk, and rum should not be mixed unless it's in cake batter, and asked Mr. Wainwright to pour the blood. Gabriel's contribution turned out to be pastry shells filled with a jiggly pink mousse. I might have suffered from dessert envy, but the filling smelled vaguely of cat food. Gabriel told Jolene he'd gotten them from a bakery downtown that she was familiar with. She was clearly delighted, eating three of them before Zeb could take a tentative bite. Zeb made a gagging sound he hadn't uttered since his dad made him try chitlins, then spat the pastry in his napkin.
"What exactly is this?" he asked.
"Heart mousse tarts," Jolene said, moaning the way I used to over cheesecake.
"Beef heart, to be exact,"
Gabriel said cheerfully, watching Jolene devour her fourth.
"They're a real delicacy," Jolene told Zeb. "We only get these at Christmas."
Zeb wiped his tongue with his napkin and smiled wanly at Jolene.
"I'll finish mine later."
Chapter 9. Werewolves are also territorial about holiday time. It would be unwise for a human to underestimate her werewolf mother-in-law's desire to see her son on Thanksgiving and Christmas Day. Mating rituals and love customs of the were. I didn't invite Gabriel to Christmas with my family, because I don't do that to people I like. Grandma Ruthie spent every Christmas Eve neck-deep in nog, feeling at liberty to tell me exactly what she thought was wrong with my life and which of my poor choices had led me there. One particularly memorable holiday in 2004, she offered to pay for plastic surgery. A total tune-up, including boobs, nose, teeth, and a little reconstruction to soften my mannish features. While generous, this offer kept me from coming to Christmas 2005. And, just as on Christmas 2005, Mama had not responded well to my skipping out on this year's family festivities. Thanksgiving was spent with Mama's extended family. I was allowed to skip it this year because the family preferred to eat lunch together, and an afternoon of watching other people eat just wasn't worth the risk of spontaneous combustion. Mama made some lame excuse to the uncles about my needing to get the bookstore ready for the Black Friday shopping rush, which seemed to satisfy everybody. Christmas, however, belonged to Mama. There was the prolonged Christmas Eve gathering in which Mama, Daddy, myself, Jenny, and her spawn, plus Grandma and that year's Grandpa, exchanged presents. We then enjoyed the traditional Jameson meal of turkey, stuffing, and a piping hot side dish of guilt-stuffed manipulation. Unmarried and childless, read, pathetic with no place to go, I usually slept at my parents' house and spent Christmas morning with them. I was one step away from wearing footy pajamas. Jenny and her boys, loaded up with sugar and obnoxiously noisy toys, usually arrived at around 6 p.m., and we were stuck together in family harmony until Mama decided to warm up leftovers for dinner and parole us until next year. I had already violated the sanctity of Christmas Eve by spending it with people who actually liked me, so avoiding my family on Christmas night this year was not an option. I showed up at sundown and gave myself a 45-minute window to duck out before anyone arrived for the warmed-over feast. Mama got her usual bottle of Windsong, which she asked for every year. I gave Daddy a book on the haunted battlefields of Kentucky, which Mr. Wainwright recommended. I got slipper socks and a copy of The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. The house seemed even more quiet than usual, the gaps in conversation echoing just how much my estrangement from Jenny was putting a strain on my parents' holiday. Mama did, however, manage to mention how much everybody missed me on Christmas Eve and that it would be so much easier if I just stayed for dinner. About 20 times. By easier, I'm pretty sure Mama meant easier for her. It was easier for her not to have to address my issues with my sister, such as the fact that Jenny had helped Missy, the psychotic real estate agent, by, albeit unwittingly, feeding her information about my schedule, River Oaks, and all manner of things that helped her harass me and frame me for murder. Oh, and the lawsuit she filed against me. That sort of discussion can put a real damper on baby Jesus's birthday. While Mama started preparations for re-dinner, I think I lost track of time talking to my dad about the possibility of tracing Mr. Wainwright's family. Normally, I can sense my grandma's approaching presence, like Bambi's mom sensing when man has entered the forest. I was caught off guard in both senses when Grandma Ruthie arrived with her newest catch, the aforementioned Wilbur. They say the mourning period for a relationship is at least one half of the time that was spent in the relationship. Grandma had reduced it to her shortest time ever, 1/27th of the relationship. I smelled Wilbur long before I saw him. This went well beyond your typical old man aroma. This was rot, decay, mold, black stinky gingivitis, and bad cheese. On top of that, he looked like a cheap Halloween mask come to life, all papery wrinkles and saggy, yellowed eyelids. Sadly, he was still better looking than former Grandpa Tom.
"Oh, Jane, I didn't know you were going to be here,"
Grandma Ruthie sniffed as Mama took her coat, the unspoken but clear sentiment being that she wouldn't have come if she'd known I was going to be there. Mama hustled their coats out of the room. Daddy, obviously determined not to get caught up in whatever was about to transpire, kept his eyes glued to the television and relentlessly changed the channel. Wilbur looked from me to Grandma to me again. I crossed my arms and grinned at Grandma, happy not to be the rude, socially backward one for once. Finally, Grandma sighed and said,
"Jane, this is my fiancé, Wilbur. Wilbur, this is Jane."
"So nice to meet you," he said. "Your grandma has told me so much about you."
"I doubt that very much," I said, smiling sweetly. I didn't flash my fangs. I'd leave it to Grandma to send senior men into mysterious cardiac arrest episodes. Wait. Did she say fiancé? I zeroed in on Grandma's left hand, where a tasteful diamond engagement ring twinkled. "You're engaged?" I gasped. "Again?" Sensing the shift in the room, Mama poked her head into the living room.
"Jane, honey, can I see you for a minute?"
Jaw unhinged, I followed Mama into the kitchen, where a wealth of Tupperware was carefully laid out in the traditional Jameson post-Christmas smorgasbord formation on the countertop. I clamped my hand over my nose when confronted with Mama's reheated fancy cheese grits made with Gouda and bacon and an obscene amount of garlic.
"Is she crazy?"
I demanded around my hand. "Is he crazy?" Mama shrugged.
"Well, I will admit that the mourning period was a little short."
"She brought a date to the burial,"
I hissed, removing my hand from my face and concentrating on talking instead of smelling. Stupid instinctual breathing.
"At the time, he was just a friend, trying to help her through a difficult time,"
Mama said in what could only be described as her denial voice. I simply watched her, expressionless, prompting Mama to say,
"Your grandma isn't like you, Jane. She's from a different time. She's the kind of woman who needs a man in her life."
"For a brief time before her evil curse kills them in a terribly ironic way," I said, which made Mama's face pucker.
"You know, this would never have happened if you'd taken my advice and put up those warning Black Widow do not marry posters with Grandma's picture down at the senior center."
"Honey, you know I don't like it when you talk that way."
"I don't like having a grandma with a 4-volume wedding album. We all have our burdens to bear." The tiniest eye twinkle under the veneer of annoyance told me Mama was trying not to laugh. "When's the wedding?" I asked.
"They haven't set a date yet," Mama said. "But you know how she likes to get married in the fall."
Mama caught herself.
"See, now you have me doing it."
I pressed my lips together to suppress the smirk.
"Wilbur seems like a very nice man," Mama told me in her don't argue voice. "He treats Grandma how gentlemen used to treat ladies. He opens doors for her. He carries heavy bags. He orders for her in restaurants."
"So he's like a concierge?" I said. Mama was not amused.
"Mama, she's going to kill another one," I moaned. "This has got to stop. Hasn't she had all the husbands she needs?"
"Shh. They're going to hear you,"
Mama said, sending furtive looks at the door. Oh, they can't hear anything. I rolled my eyes. In an obvious ploy to redirect the conversation, Mama looked furtively toward the door and said,
I've been meaning to ask you, but I didn't want to in front of your daddy. How are things going with your Gabriel?
Fine. I jerked my shoulders.
Fine?
She asked.
Just fine?
I nodded, my lips pressed tightly together, narrowing my gaze as Mama shot me a canary-devouring feline smile. She said,
You'll never guess who was asking about you at prayer meeting the other night.
You're right, I won't.
Adam Morrow. You remember you used to have such a big crush on him in high school. I used to find his name doodled all over your notebooks. Adam Morrow, Mrs. Adam Morrow, Jane Jameson Morrow, Janie Morrow, Jane and Adam.
I got it. I remember. She smiled.
Well, he has been asking about you at church. And I thought, why not ask him over for dinner sometime? A poor single boy who works as hard as he does knows how to appreciate a good home-cooked meal.
Mama, please don't. Mama pursed her lips, turning back to the steaming contents of her stove. She stirred. She salted. She tasted. Finally, she turned back to me with a dreamy expression of the generous mother goddess that, frankly, scared me. She cleared her throat and used her special, imparting motherly wisdom from the mountaintop voice.
When your daddy and I were dating, he planned on going fishing with some friends over homecoming weekend. This was back in high school. We'd only been dating a little while, and I think he didn't want me to think I could plan things out for him.
Clearly, he didn't know you very well, I said.
Mm-hmm, she said, stirring the potatoes. I told him it was perfectly fine if he wanted to go fishing with his buddies because Eddie Carroll had offered to take me to the dance.
Mr. Carroll? My math teacher?
Ew! You should have seen him in high school. With a full head of hair, he was quite the man about town. If things hadn't worked out with your father...
Stop! I told her, laughing. I do not want to hear that I could have been a Carroll.
Mama giggled. You know, he still tells me on occasion that I have lovely ankles.
They are lovely, but back to the story, please, I said, shuddering at the thought of Mr. Carroll ogling my mother at parent-teacher night.
Well, the moment your father heard that, he called his buddies and canceled the fishing trip, she said, preening. He was pinning that corsage on my dress faster than you could say, dog in the manger. And every dance or party after that, your father knew that he would be going with me because I might have other offers. Sometimes men need a little competition to realize what they have. It's healthy for a relationship.
Did Mr. Carroll really ask you to the dance? I asked. A Cheshire Cat smile spread across her face. I laughed. You know, Mama, sometimes I completely underestimate you.
You're probably right. So, if I ask a question, will you bite my head off?
She asked. You know I won't actually bite you, right?
You know what I mean, she said, tasting the gravy.
She offered me a spoonful, but I declined, as its bouquet reminded me of that smell refrigerators get after long vacations.
Why not just call Adam, honey? You were crazy about him in high school, and he's such a nice boy.
I think I'm at the point in my life where I need more than a nice boy. I need a nice man. Mama tisked and patted my cheek.
Is Gabriel a nice man?
Recalling the unfortunate Bud McElroy incident, I hesitated. Not particularly. That may be what I deserve, though. Mama sighed and stirred.
Well, I don't really follow you. I can tell you that when Eddie Carroll tried to cut in at the homecoming dance, Daddy broke his nose.
Tempting, but Gabriel might not stop at the nose.
Let things with Gabriel take their course, she intoned. And in the meantime, see where things go with Adam. In the end, knowing they have a little competition may speed things along.
Speed what things along to what? I asked. Mama shushed me and handed me a tray of eggnog and slightly damaged leftover Santa cookies. Now just take this out to them and mind your manners. Behave yourself with your grandma. I will if she will, I hissed back. When I walked back into the den, Daddy was still mindlessly changing the channels, ignoring Grandma's very presence. Wilbur and Grandma were snuggled up on the couch. Grandma was trying to tempt Wilbur with a candy cane, swiping it sensuously along his lips. Wilbur was smiling fondly at her as he reminded her about his diabetes. I guess chronic disease precluded her need to seduce him with seasonal candy. Repulsed, I turned on my heels and headed back to the kitchen, but Daddy called, "Jane?" Desperate for someone to share his suffering, he demanded, "Is that eggnog? With liquor?" I winked at him and gave him a double helping.
"It's so nice to see you helping your mama for a change,"
Grandma said, nodding imperiously toward the tray. I ignored the bait. "Would you like some?" I asked Wilbur. Wilbur was about to answer when Grandma patted his hand fondly and simpered,
"Oh, Wilbur is lactose intolerant. His stomach is just so sensitive. He can't have salt because of the high blood pressure, or sugar because of his diabetes, or fats, or nuts, or meat. He usually sticks to Ensure, or those macrobiotic shakes."
Grandma pulled a canned shake out of her enormous Enye purse. Wilbur took it out of her hand and stuck it back into her purse before I could get a good look at the label. "So, how did you two meet?" I asked. "When did you two meet?"
"Oh, it's the sweetest story," Grandma sighed. "I was on my way into Whitlow's to plan Bob's service, and Wilbur was there in the hallway waiting for a friend's visitation to start. He saw how upset I was and offered me his hanky. It was so romantic and chivalrous, I just had to invite him for a cup of coffee in Mr. Whitlow's office."
I stared at Wilbur, reaching out, trying to touch his mind. Nothing. It was like scraping my knuckles on a brick wall. Stupid, inconsistent vampire powers. "Mr. Goosen..."
"You could just call me Grandpa,"
he said, smiling. One would think that at this point in my life, with as many grandpas as I've had, one more wouldn't bother me. But something, possibly step-grandparent weariness or allegiance to Bob, made me say, "I don't think so." Grandma sighed and sent me a wounded look. Wilbur took a deep breath and sat forward, his hands in a steepled, grandfatherly stance.